Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone?
Welcome to the Twilight Zone. An ongoing walk down the terrors of memory lane. This week we're doing two episodes from the Twilight Zone Long Distance Call and Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? I've not been doing a good job of telling you what episodes are coming, but that's okay. We've just spent 20 minutes talking about Carrie for some reason. So we're going to actually get to what we came to record about. One of two, so God help us all. On panel today we've got...
Hello, this is Daniel, contributor to Popdose, and I frequently leave dirty knock-knock jokes on Heaven's answering machine.
And I'm John, and I'm the host of Mission Briefing, and occasional co-star on this podcast.
That's right. So, we'll talk about two episodes of The Twilight Zone. Both of these are from season two. We're well into the show now.
I like to ask everyone before we get into this, do you, either of you remember these two episodes before watching it for this?
Absolutely not. I don't think I've seen... No, I mean, honestly, I don't think I had seen either of these before.
I remember seeing the telephone one because I went through a brief Twilight Zone fix several years ago when it first came on Netflix, I think. And that was one of the episodes that I'd seen. I had not seen the second one.
Oh, I remember when Netflix got it and that like made headlines and like Variety and stuff.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm the opposite of you. I had never seen Long Distance Call, but I'd seen Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up before, probably on one of those sci-fi marathons that they do on New Year's.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that one has like a weird double twist in it that we'll get to when we get there. And I will say, I like you, John, I think I have seen every episode. I did a watch through... almost no one carries that horrible fourth season, right? Like where it tried to go to like an hour-long format.
I think it's on Hulu, but I've never tried to watch it.
Well, and Rod Serling's not on most of it. Like he kind of wrote it off and then came back for the fifth, even though he didn't write much for the fifth. Because like the two that you know from the fifth season, which thank you Ben Wooster for being on last week and when we covered it, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet with William Shatner and the Gremlin on the wing. And the living
dog. There is a man on the wing of this airplane.
I will say, Shatner was at full Shat right there, like because that was 3 years before Star Trek, and he breaks into a cold sweat. If you haven't rewatched it, do. But there's an air marshal on board. He steals his gun, opens up the window, and like being held by the flight attendant, he is shooting at this gremlin.
The remake of that for the movie was much better.
I disagree 100%. But again, like, because, and this is nothing on John Lithgow, who's great. He is fine in that. It's even directed by George Miller, I think,
yes.
Who did Mad Max.
It's either George... No, yeah, it's George Miller.
But there's something about the black and white and the granularity of that film that makes it all... And, I mean, and what does Shatner do? He sits down, everyone on the plane is giving him sleeping pills. And the first thing he wants to do is light up his cigarette, and his wife's like, no, no. Not until we reach cruising altitude. And you're just like, 1963.
Yes.
But we're not here to talk about that one. I only mentioned that because those are probably the two memorable episodes of that season, Telly Savalas and the Talking Tina. And Rod Serling is there hiding around the corner to give the narration. Like, that's my favorite part here. I'm playing the drinking game of where is Rod Serling going to show up? Like, he's kind of like, in the first episode we're talking about, he kind of just steals a slice of the kid's birthday cake. And he's just like... Kitten is dull.
Yep.
I'll give the narration, but it's just...
It's fantastic. He inserts himself into the narration as part of this world, almost like a Fox Mulder or a Smoking Man from X-Files.
Well,
like, he's there, but he's in the background somewhere.
Season one ended with them very explicitly acknowledging that,
yes,
Rod Serling was there.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
And as they write him out, which I think you were on that episode.
Yes, yeah, I was, yeah.
And that's awesome. Mm-hmm. But let me give you the opening narration here, which I will say in season two and season three and the just those two episodes of season five, we don't start out with the narration anymore. It's kind of, it starts a few minutes in, but we started this damn format. I'm going to continue it. As must be obvious, this is a house hovered over by Mr. Death. What a stupid start. Sorry. As must be obvious, this house is hovered over by Mr. Death.
Now, I hate to cut you off. Are we talking about the same Mr. Death from One for the Angels? Do you think that that's just what they were trying to
all
continue?
The time? I mean, I imagine it's always the same Mr. Death because it's an awesome character, but whatever. An omnipresent player to the third and final act of every life. And it's been said, and probably rightfully so, that what follows this life is one of unfathomable mysteries. An area of darkness which we, the living, reserve for the dead. Or so it is said. For in a moment, a child will try to cross that bridge which separates light and shadow. And of course, he must take the only known route, that indistinct highway through the region we call the Twilight Zone. It's funny because Rod Serling is not writing this episode. He gives that narration. And I think it's funny to hear someone else write for his voice because it's almost there. This one's too long. It's a little bit too many words, and none of them are, except for unfathomable, which is an impossible word to say, there aren't too many big words either. He likes to use a lot of pontification, but still, man, that's pretty creepy. We're going to watch a kid die in this episode. Woo! Let's get into it.
Yeah. It's a pretty dark episode, isn't
it? This is a very depressing episode for just what that kid has to see.
Well, and doesn't have to see. Because they, like, intentionally keep the grandma away, and then he kind of comes in because he wants to see the grandma, and then kind of sneaks around. It's something. So, John, you want to give the synopsis of what this is?
Sure. Like we said, Mr. Death is hovering over this house. It's the little boy's birthday, and the grandmother, the father's mother, is there to... wish him happy birthday, and she makes it. We are introduced to her as a loving grandmother. Like she dotes on her son, she dotes on her grandson. She doesn't really interact with the mother too much, and that plays in later on. But she's obviously very ill, and she takes ill at the end of the birthday party. She is confined to bed, and later we find out that she died. And the parents try to shield the son from seeing her on her deathbed. But they eventually all come in, and I forget if she says something to him, but he says something like, I'm here. But importantly, during the birthday, she gives him her birthday gift, and it's a telephone.
Yeah.
And she says, if you ever want to talk to me, I'm just a phone call away.
And by the way, you know what show you're watching, and so the second she says that, you know what the second act is going to be.
Yep.
But you don't know what the twist is. That's something I like about this episode, because I figured haunted phone, whether or not the parents would hear it. I didn't expect child suicide or whatever.
That's where this episode stands out from other episodes. Like it could be just a haunted telephone like we've seen before with haunted dolls, things like that. But this one, the grandmother, we are led to believe, is talking to the child through the telephone after she dies. We think it's him just processing her death.
Yeah.
But really, it's her telling him, I want you to be with me, kill yourself.
That's right.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how this episode works. I imagine it's Serling's baby. He's at the head of, like, the pitch meetings. In the back of my head, I just say, there's a pitch. But the pitch is the opening narration. And then Serling tries to predict where it's going. Right? Mm-hmm. And then he goes, but what's the twist? And he goes, child death. And you're like,
I mean, for today, this would be kind of a funky episode. Well, for the 60s, I can only imagine.
Dude. I imagine the 60s, they more said, oh, well, the kid's got to see someone die. That's how they'll become a man.
Child death was a thing more back then.
Well, grandma's death will teach you what it was like to be in the war.
Did you notice that she was German?
I did. Very clearly, like...
Yes.
This woman got her start in, like, Eastern German film and then came over and, like...
It kind of got me thinking, like, so how did she come over to America? Was she a war bride? Was she a, evacuee?
Yes.
Was she, on an Eastern German, like, play touring America and then defected?
Well, her rat tunnel was severely in the wrong direction. So.
Like, she was performing in a play in West Berlin the day the wall went up, and she's like... I'm staying.
That's just not a booby.
There we go. So as this is Daniel, game Daniel likes to play, there's two people of note who acted in this. The mother, who's Jenny Maxwell, who you may or may not know, her most iconic role is she is the love interest in Blue Hawaii, the Elvis Presley movie. But the kid is a huge deal. The kid appeared in Twilight Zone and an Alfred Hitchcock Presents And he was Will Robinson in the original Lost in Space.
Oh. He's going to show up later as some, It's a Good Life?
It's The Good Life, that's right. Which is the next season. But yeah, that's the kid.
I thought that's who that was.
Because I was actually telling Daniel earlier, like, he had some strange acting in this. And I wasn't sure if it was the actor or the director. But if he went on to do bigger and better things, it must be the director.
In his most famous Twilight Zone episode, he does the same acting style, but he's the villain. So it makes a lot more sense.
Right. In this show, like, this was like probably his second or third episode. Mm. Oh, shit. He's also in the one you were saying, It's a Good Life, right? But he comes back in the second revival series playing a dad, I think.
Oh, it's cool. It's a direct sequel to It's a Good Life.
With the daughter, it's still a good life.
Right. We'll talk about it when we get to It's a Good Life.
Wow.
Which is, I think, the next episode even. But like, he had already been in Alfred Hitchcock Presents. This is one of those kids who probably ended up getting the labor laws changed for kids, because he was in like a dozen episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents as well. Was on The Greatest Show on Earth, and then ended up as Will Robinson, all in like a 5-year span, and just like, oh, this kid never went to school. Yeah. This is probably not a good situation.
He never saw a dime of any of that money.
Yeah. He turned out to be okay, though, relatively speaking. He acted as an adult, and I don't recall hearing any like, what was his name, Bill Mummy?
Yeah, that's right.
I don't recall ever reading any stories about, Bill Mummy is a heroin addict who was found passed out in an alley somewhere in New York.
No, I mean, he just retired, which is the way to
fine.
Go.
Yeah.
It's like how Charlie and Willy Wonka became a vet.
I mean, good for him. He moved on.
God, I mean, I was going to say, like, there's a lot to talk about here. I don't know how much there is actually to talk about here. It's just a really weird episode. It's like the kid's 5th birthday or whatever they say it is, 10th birthday.
Yeah, he's five. Because he was still taking a nap, which I thought was odd for a 5-year-old, but
whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Well, we haven't got that far yet in our children, so.
Well, the whole thing about this opening is it's the kid's birthday and grandma's there, and, you know, she's very dedicated to her grandson, and there's even the scene where she asks her grandson to tell her what his birthday wish was, and we never find out what that was, which probably
doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
Well, I'm thinking that's what caused the magic with the telephone, but yeah, act is just entirely that birthday party, and then grandma.
It's a very long first act.
And then grandma starts acting weird and sick.
1960s sick. She starts coughing and looking frail. Like,
so the consumption.
That's right. She practically takes out a folded like cloth and. Oh no, blood. And again, it's after this, like, the second or third most awkward birthday we've seen in a while, because they're like, oh boy, a cake. Make a wish, Billy, before grandma dies. You're like, oh, what?
Before grandma dies.
Oh, and then Billy eats that cake like it's a sandwich.
Yeah. Oh, dude, he just picks that thing up. Yeah. Bold choice, Billy.
Which is probably the most realistic part about this.
It took 45 takes, and the kid ate all the cake.
That's some Werner Herzog.
But as far as Charles' birthday parties, it was the parents and the grandmother.
Now,
that was
Billy,
the birthday party.
You are to eat the cake. It is the most important consumption you will have today.
Speaking of consumption.
That's right. God, it's just all weird. The parents are like, hey, here's some presents. And the grandma's like, open my present, Billy. And like this,
we mentioned the grandmother was foreign,
but specifically, she has this haunted, vacant expression, and she's dressed like she's in a Victorian nightmare. Like, she has this high-collared, black-frilled like dress on, and it's all in the actress. It's well done, but like, she's haunted this whole time, and you're like, oh, grandma's gonna die,
grandma's dressed like Miss Havisham.
She is.
Yeah.
The dad is very much like, now, Billy, you know, grandma's getting old. Everyone's like, she's going to die by the end of the first act.
And she does.
And she does.
And they bring in the doctor, and she's on her deathbed, and the doctor basically just, he goes to the dad and just shakes his head. It's like, nope. And
don't they acknowledge that grandma's all delirious now because they've just given her so many pills?
Dude, and she starts saying your mother sucks, which is something.
Yeah.
I forget exactly what the line is. Like, well, your father left me for a woman. And you're just like, alrighty.
Well, what she's basically saying is she loves her grandson so much because it's a surrogate for her own son who unfortunately had to grow up and get married.
Right. And her son, the father of the boy... tells his wife, because she's getting hysterical later on as to, like, why is your mother haunting this my son? Or why do I think your mother is haunting my son? And he's like, well, because I had older siblings, and they all died. And so, so she put all of her effort into me, and then I met you, and we got married, and we had Billy, and she put all her effort into my son. And oh, that's where that connection
that's
comes.
That's right.
The worst part of all this, though, is when they're trying to... When she has her episode and it's being led upstairs and Billy's just saying, like, don't be sick, Grandma. And I'm like, oh, fucking hell. The 60s just did not care.
I guess as far as a made-for-TV kind of thing goes, it does children dealing with death pretty well. Everything the kid says and does is fairly believable for what a child will process if they don't understand what death is.
Right. Yeah.
Like talking on the telephone to grandma. Like, okay, that's make-believe. Okay. But then it's actually grandma.
Well, let's go ahead and get through this part. Grandma obviously dies, and the second act is the kid talking on the telephone with someone who claims is grandma. Again, this is super depressing because... he'll like say, I was talking to grandma on the phone and she's lonesome.
Well, right. but we got to be clear here. First, like you said, the first act is long. It's really one scene broken up by like the hider in the house, Rod Serling, who's just like, here I am eating cake. That toy is pretty creepy, huh? Look at that kid.
Pay attention to that.
But like of the 22-minute episode, there's like 10 and a half minutes where this woman is dying. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Like, yeah. And then there's the scene with like a nurse who says literally nothing. A doctor who's like, well, she's hopped up on goofballs.
She's dead,
not
going
to make it through the night. Right?
Doesn't Billy watch her die?
Well, right. Because it's kind of like, this is your last moment to say goodbye to your grandma. And then she's just like, your mother's a whore. And then you're just like, oh, right. Yeah. And end of scene.
She knows who Billy is, which is something.
And the mom's upset, and she's like, well, I mean, she was delirious on goofballs, and you knew she always hated you. Moving on. And then, like...
Which I'm sure no wife has ever felt of her mother-in-law before.
Completely unrelatable by anyone. Well, she's in hell now for all those things she did in the war. Bye! Anyway, and then at this point... We have kind of the beginning of the second... I guess it's the second act. It doesn't matter. Like, the rest of the episode, the weirdness increases because it's not just what Daniel says. It's that, like, the mom wakes up in the middle of the night-ish because she hears the kid giggling. And the kid's like, I'm talking to grandma. And you're like, well, I know it's show I'm watching, so it's clearly a cursed phone. It is unsettling because you're like, is this an imaginary friend? Is it healthy? What's going on here?
Well, even then, I mean, that was... For the 1960s, especially, a fairly realistic depiction of what grief would look like in a 5-year-old.
Sure.
Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I had no more to add.
No. But, like, and then more and more, like, the kid's like, I'm talking to grandma. I don't want to come down for dinner. I'm talking to grandma. And it's something that they do well. Same with the Talkie Tina, which, again, you heard the episode even though it hadn't happened yet. Like, chronologically, this one came first.
Mm-hmm.
It's... just looks like a toy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is a Fisher-Price, like, my friend phone that probably had a little string so he could pull it, and just, you know, it's plastic and nonsense.
Well, it looks like one of those Great Gatsby phones from the 1920s. It's got, like, the ivory receiver and speaker.
I don't even think it's that real. I really think it's a cheap nothing plastic. Well, I mean,
just
back
like,
then.
You know, a rotary type.
Here's Fisher another
Price
thing that
part.
I'd like to point out about the episode. We talked the last time that you and I talked, Nick. I think Ben interrupted us, which, curse you, Benjamin!
That's
no,
right.
No, he's cool. They were shooting episodes on video to try and save costs, and I'm pretty sure this is one of them, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's literally the production note that, like, I think they were making it for $65,000 an episode.
Yeah.
This one costs closer to $30,000. Again, like, it's one of those things, I guess it's John Carpenter is the best at it. When you're watching Halloween, the special effects are nonsense, are nothing, are they're good, but they're minimal, because what's scarier than suburban life?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that your kid is playing a game you don't understand is part of a parent's life. Like, explain the rules to me, because I'm not 3 and I don't understand what you're doing. Fine. But then there are rules to this world that you're starting to understand are being broken.
Now,
and
I
that
remember...
makes it creepy. Like, that really works.
I remember a Ray Bradbury short story. I think it was Ray Bradbury. May not have been. But was this ever a Twilight Zone episode where it's pretty much that, where all the kids are playing this one game together and they won't explain what it is? And eventually
it's... aliens.
Yeah, exactly. Is that a Twilight Zone?
It's either that or Outer Limits. I thought it was Twilight Zone. I remember it being black and white.
I remember reading the story more than seeing an episode, but thinking about it, I was like, that had to be an episode. It just had to be.
It's creepy to that point. Again, it's children which are creepy enough, like the Blair Witch. The creepiest scene is those kids laughing in the darkness, and then you see all the hands on the tent.
Well, and the episode that the kid comes back for.
Oh, yeah, it's a good life.
Or exactly. Is that the one with the kid sending him to the cornfield?
Yep.
Yeah, that's okay. Matt, what's his name? Elijah from Children of the Corn, right? Malachi.
Malachi and Isaac.
Right. I mean, but, like, that's what you want. I mean, we don't have to go full J-horror with, like, jangly kids. Just overly confident, precocious asshole kids. Mm-hmm. Really are creepy in this. Like, yeah. I'm talking to grandma.
Again, it's very like they're breaking the rules of what we consider to be normal. Well, and as children, like children do that all the time. Like Nick and Daniel and I, we were playing with our daughters, and like one of them wanted to watch the other one get undressed and into the bathing suit. It's like, that's just what kids do. But as an adult, you're like, no, don't. But the kid doesn't understand why.
To clarify, it's John and Nick's daughters. Yes. I don't have any children.
He's available, ladies.
hey.
All 10 of you.
But, like, again, it's children. We expect children to break social norms. But when they break those norms, adults panic because we don't know how to explain a norm to a child other than we don't do that.
Well, yeah. Because adults, from a kid's perspective, overanalyze everything. Yeah. I mean, it's easy for an adult to explain why something wouldn't be appropriate, but that's just because we've got a lot more knowledge about it. Whereas with a kid, if you try and use that same explanation, it sounds like nonsense.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, how do you explain social norms to someone who doesn't understand social norms? Like, they're still getting the grasp of it. Mm-hmm. And when you bring in natural norms, like death, how do you explain to someone who doesn't understand life and death that someone who's dead can't be talking to you?
Well, I mean, I remember in 2011 when my grandfather passed away, which, real sad all around, but one of my cousins who'd had young kids at this point didn't show up for the funeral specifically because he didn't want... Not that he didn't want to, he just felt he couldn't explain what death was to his kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I imagine it's a conversation every parent has to have with their kids at some point, and they deal with it, like I said earlier, like they deal with it pretty well with this episode. Like, this is how a child would process the death of a loved one. I don't know whether or not the grandmother lived with the family. I kind of get the impression she didn't, but she was still close.
I don't think she did, but yeah, you're right.
If she was so attached to the son and the grandson, I can't imagine her living too far away.
Well, another big thing about all this is, let's skip ahead here a little bit. First, Billy tries to play out in the street, and there's that whole scene where the babysitter's panicking and trying to tell what went on, because I guess both the parents work.
Were they working, or were they on a date?
They were out.
They come back, and there's a babysitter there, and she's panicking because there's a strange man in their living room who says, I nearly ran over your kid because he ran out into the street.
Right, and the strange man's trying to say, hey, I'm scared out of my life because I almost ran over a kid. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to figure out what's going on. And I think it's at that point the kid says, once again, that he was talking to grandma. And so they're trying to put two and two together there.
Yeah, I think he said something to either the babysitter or the strange man. He said something along the lines of, like, I was told to do it, or she said I should do it, or something like that.
There's never a moment in the episode, just to be clear, where the kid says, oh, yeah, grandma told me to kill myself.
Right.
Well, and I mean, again, they want to blame the babysitter at first, but it was clear that, like, she was doing what she was supposed to, and it just keeps going from there. Eventually, like, we've established that they have, like, a koi pond in the back of their yard.
Oh, yeah, there's that scene where Billy's mom comes out and asks him what he's doing. He's, like, just staring at the fish.
The fish. And
have you seen a koi pond? Staring at the fish is fun.
Yeah. They're huge. They're creepy and huge.
Every Chinese restaurant I went to growing up had a koi pond right by the cash register. Yep.
Anyway, and then, like, we have a scene late at night where Billy apparently runs and he, like, tries to drown himself in the pool.
Well, what happens was Mom hears Billy talking to Grandma again, so she takes the phone from him and hears something, and she's in such shock, she drops the phone and breaks it. So Billy's like, oh, you broke my phone. And then Mom's freaked out because she heard Grandma, and right when she's talking to her husband about what she heard, that's when Billy runs away from them and drowns himself in the koi pond.
Right. The koi eat him to death. And that's the end of the episode.
The end, yes.
Harakoi.
Yeah, that's right. That was
it's a very extensive epilogue, though.
Yeah, that was almost a joke there. I feel good about myself.
And then the doctor returns saying, oh, fuck, these people. And, I mean, the same nurse is there looking solemn. Yeah. And
the EMTs are there, or the fire department, or whoever it was that they called.
50 people are in the house. The mom's crying in the kitchen. And the dad in his smoking jacket is like, what about this phone? And we get this well-done, well-delivered, but very bizarre monologue by this father into the phone asking for his son back from a ghost phone.
I don't think it's even that bizarre under the circumstances. Oh, he's, you know, he's scared out of his mind that he's going to lose his child.
Yes, but it is a scene from it would be something Jimmy Stewart would deliver at the end of a Capra film, but it is a man in a phone that has been stomped by his wife. Like,
oh well, heck, I just want you to deliver my son back, ghost. Could you do that?
Basically, curse you, yeah. Curse you, Fisher Price, and your adorable toys. But yeah, I mean,
oh heck, gee whiz, Fisher Price, you don't know what sort of Satan you unleashed on the world.
There you go. But yeah, I mean, and then the kid comes back, and it's a happy ending? Question mark.
I guess. Yeah.
Well, it ends when Dad uses the phone to talk to his mother and begs her for Billy back, even though she's lonesome. And at that point in time, the doctors and the medics who were attending him said, look, he doesn't have a good chance. He's probably going to die. And after that conversation, I guess they detect a pulse or they detect breathing.
He comes back to life.
He comes back and they're like, I don't know what we did, but I think he's going to be okay.
Dude, it's the 1950s. All of a sudden, the cigarette started glowing, and they offered him a highball. Like,
oh, there you go.
But, I mean, and then,
oh, heck, gee whiz, Junior. You haven't lived until you've had your first eyeball.
But, I mean,
I don't know about you guys, but I didn't recognize any of the equipment that they were using.
Oh, no.
No.
It was just, again, it was like, well, check his cigarette level.
It's like there's an air tank, and you're right. Like, they could have been pumping him full of whiskey for all I know. Like, I don't know.
It's the 50s, probably.
I mean, and my joke, I think, totally works here. Because didn't she say she had 5 kids who died in, like, when they were kids, right? And so I imagine, because they're kids who died, they went to heaven. But what gets you out of heaven? Suicide. So she was in hell by herself. That's why she was lonely. Oh, yeah. She had done shit during the war.
Well, why didn't she just ask Pip then to conjure up Billy?
Oh, anyway. So I'll give the closing narration. We can jump to the next episode. A toy telephone, an act of faith. A set of improbable circumstances. Nonsense, he means. All combined to probe a mystery, to fathom a depth, to send a facet of life into a dark after region, to be believed or disbelieved depending on your frame of reference, a fact or fantasy, a substance or shadow, but all of it very much a part of the Twilight Zone. Okay.
That is a good approximation of the theme song there.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
We're back. This time we're talking about a Rod Serling episode, actually. Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? Episode 64 of The Twilight Zone, because they filmed 200 of these things. I'll do my opening narration and we'll get to it. Wintry February night. The present. Thanks, Rod. Order of events. A phone call from a frightened woman noting the arrival of an unidentified flying object. Fox Mulder was unavailable. Then the checkout you've witnessed. 2 state troopers verifying the event, but with nothing more enlightening to add beyond the evidence of some tracks leading to the highway to a diner. You've heard of trying to find a needle in a haystack? Well, stay with us now, and you'll be part of an investigating team whose mission is not to find the proverbial needle. No, their task is even harder. They've got to find a Martian in a diner. And in just a moment, you'll search with them, because you've landed in the Twilight Zone. I mean, come on. That is such a great... And again, this is one of, like, spot the Rod Serling. You kind of see, like 2 state troopers. They got their flat caps on. They're out there And then Rod Serling is standing in the snow in a woolen overcoat going like, guess what, fuckers?
Leaning against a rock.
I've had several highballs. I don't feel the cold. We're ready to go.
I'm out here wandering looking for a Bigfoot, and a UFO showed up. Hey! Like, come on.
Well, also this episode is another that features a professional dancer, because Rod Serling had a type.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
He was at Atlantic City all the time. Or I guess Vegas. He was probably in LA. So he went to the... He made the run to Vegas now and again.
Picture, if you will, you providing me a dance in the private room back there. Will be an intimate dance.
That was his pickup line? Picture, if you will.
Yeah.
Picture a man expecting to see breasts. He has entered... Oh, God. What would be the strip club? The Starlight Zone?
I know. Twilight Zone is still pretty good.
I was going to say.
Because of the time it takes place, and I was thinking the Carousel Club, but that probably would be inappropriate.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a phenomenal bottle episode, effectively. Like, other than the woman who's calling the state troopers, they follow the tracks. They're like, hey, what's that light over there? Oh, it looks like a diner. And we're just at kind of like a greasy spoon off the interstate.
What happens... Sorry to interrupt, Nick.
No, clearly. What do you got? It's more important than what I was in the middle of saying, dipshit.
What happens...
Sorry, just interrupt.
No, go ahead and interrupt.
No, you're fine.
What happens is these two deputies go up on a lake where a UFO fell, and they find the crash site, and they find footprints leading away from it towards the diner. So the rest of the episode takes place in the diner.
That's right. I mean, and then all it is kind of like checking around the diner, and they're like, well, what's going on? And he goes, well, the bridge is kind of snowy. And it sounds like this is just a Greyhound bus, and they take a rest stop every few hours. Like, he's taking his Union 30 after 5 hours driving, but the snow has come in, and they're like, look, the bridge is blocked up. We'll have a crew out here probably by morning. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, he goes, oh, well, that sucks. In the meantime, I just have to look at my, like, six passengers. He's like, but there's seven other people in this bar. And so it's all like, well, who's the alien? Alien? Will the real aliens please stand up?
I'm the real Martian. Yes, I'm the real Martian. All you other Martians.
And by the way, there's a joke here at the end that is phenomenally great and phenomenally stupid, which is like...
It turns the episode on its head. The episode before the final scene stands alone as like a fantastic episode.
Right.
You throw that last scene in there and that's Twilight Zone.
And yes, it's even more like, because it's always like, we've made this reference before, but it's the squeaky door on Futurama where it's like the stupid version of the Twilight Zone. And it's always, and it turns out it was man, right? Like, and it's just like, because it has to hit you over the head of the moral.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just like, you thought this was silly. Wait for the second. Like, are you just racist and think that all aliens are Martians? Right?
Well,
that's the end.
I think Treehouse of Horror on The Simpsons did it better, because that was the whole joke. It's like, oh, these 1950s sensibilities. Oh, well, that's just hilarious how people couldn't conform.
Did they do this on The Simpsons? This one?
Not this particular one, no.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was like, but yeah, but regardless. So this whole thing is a bottle episode where everyone's kind of trapped waiting for the snow, and like the bridge is blocked. Like, he's like, look, with that much snow piled on the bridge, I don't even think I could get the bus out of here. So we got to figure this out, and we have until morning. And guess what? They don't figure it out, really.
Mm-hmm.
Which is somehow even greater.
Yeah, I mean, the police even say, like, we can't charge people with suspicion of being a Martian.
Yeah.
That's not something we can hold people on.
Which is so great.
Now, this episode name checks Ray Bradbury. I think the old coot at the bar, like, says it's like, sci-fi story like Ray Bradbury. Were him and Rod Serling rivals at the time?
I think there was a sci-fi club where him, probably L. Ron Hubbard, like they were all doing drinking and sex magic, like,
well, probably Isaac Asimov too.
The guy who started the JPL, the Jet Propulsion Lab, was also one of these Aleister Crowley nonsense people, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Rod Serling was into sex magic, because gross. But I think he was there at the party, like the first act of the party where everyone was drinking and eating like cheap food, and then he's like, all right, I know where this is going. Time to hit the writing room.
Well, after he saw Harlan Ellison sticking his whole fist up L. Ron Hubbard's butthole,
he's like,
that was just the end of it.
He's like, L. Ron, you're my puppet now. He goes, you're not invited in the Sea Corps anymore. Ah! So I guess we should kind of get through this.
Someone calls into the sheriff and says they something fell into the woods in, I guess, this podunk town or middle of nowhere. Sheriff goes to check it out. They see that some trees are knocked down. Something fell into the pond, and there are footsteps leading in the snow from the pond toward this diner across the highway.
Right.
We are never told or introduced to the person who made the call.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we don't know who the hell this person is, who must obviously be nearby.
Right.
And their first conclusion is Martian.
That's right.
Even though this is the 60s and Russian doesn't even come into it.
Yeah.
Not even for a scoop. He looks at them like, them's a Martian ship. I've seen them before.
Well, it's
like, all right.
It's a Twilight Zone episode. They couldn't just flat out say Russian. They had
now,
to say Martian.
It'd be
Martian.
Fun if they assumed it was Russian and then they get led to believe that it's a Martian somehow.
Well, that's
like they're after an alien.
Dude,
well, that's
it's the Back to the Future 2. Like, he thinks it's a Russian MiG and then a kid is reading a comic book that says creatures from space. He's like, that makes more sense somehow.
Exactly.
They already did that episode anyway with the monsters are due on Maple Street.
Okay. Well, yeah, but it turns out to be stupid Martians. That is a great episode
unlike
with a very cheesy ending.
Yes. Unlike this one.
You know what? I think I will say this is a better episode than that. But anyway, I mean, they're both good. Okay, so I guess we should get through these people. There's the harumph businessman.
Yep. I have a meeting in Boston in the morning. Please make the moon move so I can get there.
He's pretty much Hedley Lamarr in Blazing Saddles.
He is.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I'll get into some of these actors and actresses in a second. We have the young married couple where she, about halfway through, realizes, wait, I don't recognize that mole on your chin. Maybe you're an alien, which is whatever.
Oh, that's great how they turn married couples against each other.
Yeah. There's a slightly older couple who's just, you know, I mean, they really have very little to do in this. There's the single woman who, again, like you said, is his type, the exotic dancer, who ends up, like, about to shack up with the bus driver, which is funny by the end of it.
Because he says, like, well, she's the only one I noticed.
That's right.
Yep.
And then he and the sheriff watch her as she gets onto the bus, just, like, leering at her.
That's right. And then there's the greatest actor of all time, the crazy old prospector, who's, I don't remember you on the bus either. And you're just like, woo-hoo.
The actor's name is Jack Elam, I think. And he was in a whole bunch of Westerns. He was in Once Upon a Time in the West, Support Your Local Sheriff, which I know Nick was the one that pointed that out to me.
High Noon.
Yeah, he was in a bunch of stuff.
And he's kind of not one of the brothers on Gunsmoke. But he's always there in Gunsmoke. Like, he has a bunch of credits on that. And he has your classic character builder from the 1960s to the 1980s, which is a good lazy eye. Mm-hmm. And it is just wibbly-wobbling all over the place. And he's looking at people all grizzled. He's like, you could be the alien. And he's...
he's comic relief.
He's
really
great.
Is, yeah.
He lines us up, and everyone's on his side. Like, constantly, the barback's on his side. Or, I guess, the diner guy. For those of you who've watched Gravity Falls, he's essentially H.R. McGucket, like an old prospector just kind of howling at the moon, and he's awesome. I can mention some other people in this. John Hoyt is in it. He was in Julius Caesar, Spartacus, and Rift movie for Cineprov, Flesh Gordon.
Wow.
He was also in Cleopatra. You have the bombshell who just, her name is Jean Wiles. She was in like 1,000 things, but she's always
bombshell,
the bombshell.
Number two.
Yeah, that's right. And then Bernie Phillips, who is the barback, who is you'd recognize as from Dragnet. He's the sergeant in Dragnet.
Oh.
That should have been James Earl Jones.
The barback?
Yeah, as the proprietor.
Yeah,
Daniel and I were talking earlier, like, is he black? Is he supposed to be black? His indeterminate race?
Well, he honestly just looked like young James Earl Jones and Doctor Strangelove to me. So it would have been so much better if they got him in that.
Well, I mean, and he's good in this. Yes, and it is the 1960s, so if there's a black dude in the scene, it's supposed to be about race, which it shouldn't be. And it turns out that he's an alien, so maybe you don't want the one black guy to be an alien.
Hey, whoa, spoilers.
Hitting the nail on the head.
For a 60-year-old episode,
Yes, that's the reveal there.
But yeah.
But the police talk to everybody, like, well, you know, who are you? Where were you going? And... like, they interview everybody, and everybody seems to think that they all were supposed to be there. The driver doesn't remember who the exact six people were,
No. Mm-hmm.
So he's of no help.
Well, plus throughout the episode, whoever the alien is starts making the power go off and making the jukebox play by itself.
Which is a way to just really literally screw with people. Like, it has nothing to do with anything, yeah. And they're looking for, like, it to be evidence, but now... And then there's the bus driver, who's this surly guy. He's played by John Archer, and for those of you who are comic book fans, he on the radio was the voice of The Shadow, Lamont Cranston.
All right.
So there you go. I mean...
And, I remember that radio program.
I remember the terrible Alec Baldwin movie. Yeah. Oof. but, I mean... I mention all this to say, like, when we do these, there's, like, two or three actors who matter.
Yeah.
This one really does have a cool cast. This is a neat bottle episode where everyone is well acted. Even the two, like, lovebirds who really are there to just fill the scene out, they don't have many lines, but they sell it. This is a good episode.
It really is. And I love this type of drama, like you said, a bottle drama, where they're all in one space, they're trapped, and there's no... plot other than that they're trapped and there's some sort of paranoia going on. Like, actually watching this, I was reminded of the comic The Sandman. There's a similar scene where there's a bunch of people trapped in a diner.
Oh yeah,
and
where
the guy with like a memory crystal or something like that is making them do crazy things, and it's like hour by hour it tells what he's doing to them.
You do realize that you've just not ruined, but Neil Gaiman, I've been reading Good Omens.
Yeah, fantastic. Right. Yeah,
good
and
book.
But you realize almost everything. He might be the most Twilight Zone-y person ever, because like even X-Files, which I love, you know, Chris Carter is also a little bit All the President's Men. Neil Gaiman is just like, what if the Twilight Zone was just a thing? Because that's what Good Omens is like. So there's literally a demon and an angel on Earth, and they both want humanity to survive because the demon likes fucking with humans and the angel loves humans, so they're gonna work together. And then let's see what happens.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And you throw in Terry Pratchett for humor, and you have a gold-winning thing.
Yeah.
Well, plus that Sandman episode was literally about people meeting up in a bar while the world was ending, I think, right?
Right. Which, again, you know, get Nick Frost out here. Like, get Simon Pegg, and let's go to a bar at the end of the world, because I'm at that bar with you, right? Yeah. The world is ending? We're having a fucking pint, right? Like, that's it.
And the tension is created from they can't leave. Yeah. Or they've nowhere to go. And
it's because the universe is literally ending, so they can't go anywhere except there.
And like, I love those episodes in Sandman, but also in various other things like this. And I loved how, like Nick said, a lot of the characters didn't really do much, but what they had to do, they did. So like, they portrayed the paranoia like, oh, well, if one alien came in, then you can discount all the couples. And then the newlywed turns to her fiance or husband or whoever and says, did you always have that mole?
Meanwhile, the two that look like they're like well-dressed refugees in the back are just sinking in their chair. They're like, we just want to get back on the bus, guys.
Exactly.
And so like at the end of the night, like the old prospectors are like, maybe it was me. Maybe it was you. I don't remember you.
I do find it hard to believe that no one remembered everybody.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Sandman, maybe that prospector had been given the key to hell and everybody's meeting up to try and claim it from him.
That's right.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, that would be a different episode, a different twist.
It would be.
God, this episode is good. And it's funny because, like, we're going to talk about this one probably shorter than the first one just because that's the nature of these podcasts. This one is all verbal sprawling because, like, I mean, John already gave away the ending, kind of, which is that they're like, well, before the twist, which is that... The state trooper's like, we can't hold you on being an alien when there's no evidence of anything. And also, that's nonsense. It's like, we're going to get you for illegally parking a spacecraft in this woman's backyard. Like, what are you going to do?
What happens at the end... Well,
let's finish this out first before we give the twist away.
Okay.
So, like you alluded to, they're there essentially through the night because there's a bad snowstorm. And one way or another, they're trapped until the plow can plow the bridge the next morning. And so... They're nervously kind of shuffling around, getting this greasy spoon food. Like, and at the end, they check out, and like the one guy has 14 cups of coffee, which, my God, 14 cups of diner coffee. He's been to the bathroom.
But he only paid like $1.40 for it.
That's right. You know, you have a burger for 30 cents. Yeah. You have cup of coffee.
That, Fry in Futurama when he got his tax rebate back and decided to buy 100 cups of coffee.
Like, just the guy is seeing through time at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Although, if I recall, it turns out to be the titular Martian was the guy who did that. I mean, you have the old couple, like the young couple split a malt, right? Then they all get onto the bus, and we see them one by one getting onto the bus.
Right, because the police clear it. They say the city engineer, the state engineer, whatever, has said the bridge is fine. You can go about your day.
And the wealthy man in the overcoat, who's now accused everyone, is like, I don't know if I trust the government, or whatever he says. And he goes, what are you going to do? The state trooper literally goes, like, look, we'll guide you over the bridge, but I count 7 people other than you on the bus. And he goes, what are you going to do? Right?
Yeah. Which, you know, is, you know, the city at its work. It's like, we can't say this didn't happen. Right. But, yeah, you know, yeah, just take your chances.
And I mean, again, like, this one is, in the first half, we complain how long the first act is. The first act of this one is 20 seconds. It's almost a prologue. Mm-hmm. And then there's only one act the entire time until the epilogue, which is them, what's about to happen. But this is just like, this is a comedy, almost. But it's also the most real thing. Again, if you look for metaphors to whatever, communism, let's say, this is perfect. This is like, you're a communist. No, you're a communist. How do I know that you weren't a communist first? And you're just like, this is all nonsense. And the crazy guy in the corner is like, maybe he's both a communist. And you're just like...
I'm on the side of the crazy guy.
I think
crazy
we all
guy's
are.
The best.
Yeah.
Everyone loves crazy
He's the
guy.
Only one with a character other than the angry businessman.
That's right. Yeah. And the debutante's like, well, maybe I'm the alien. Hey, bus driver. Wink. And you're just like, all right.
I mean, I have expected the bus driver to say that he was the alien.
I could have been.
Because no one said, well, I recognize the bus driver.
That's right. That's
true. He's one of that service industry type where he's wearing the hat. He's just a blank face.
That's right. It's the Shawshank Redemption, like, when was the last time you looked at a man's shoes? You're just like, oh no, space shoes, I guess.
So they all leave.
And they all leave. John, give us a twist.
And like this threw me a little bit, because I actually, the way they cut the scene made me think that as soon as the bus left, someone else walked into the bar.
That's right.
But it was in fact, I guess, minutes or hours later.
Probably not hours, but time
it was
passes.
Later, yes. Yeah. And someone walks into the bar. And there's the barkeep there, or the you know, whoever he is, and it's the well-dressed businessman. Yeah. And he comes walking in, he says, turns out the bridge was faulty, everybody fell to their deaths.
That's right. And he just says it so matter-of-factly, like he still just missed his business meeting.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, the bridge was bad, everyone died.
Well, it sounded to me like he was speaking in a state of shock, which is kind of good.
Eh. Yeah, and then the bartender says, like, so everyone fell into the river and drowned, right? Yeah. So why are you dry?
Yeah.
Like, oh, and the guy, like, looks at himself, like, dry.
Don't know that word.
Yeah, don't know that word.
And it's just, again, it's good because it's stupid, matter of fact, and you get it immediately. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the thing.
This is it, yeah.
And then it takes another twist.
And then he's like, he's taking a drink and he's lighting a cigarette. So he's got one hand with a cigarette, one hand with a cigarette case and the lighter, and then another hand comes out and he's holding the coffee and he's got three hands. And they're working. I kept expecting, like, which one is his real hand? And they
which
work
one's
pretty
the poor
well.
PA?
Exactly. Like... Which one's the one giving him the reach around and just like lighting a cigarette? And yeah, like he's like, oh, so I'm the vanguard of Martian invasion force, and we're gonna set up shop here in this little town. And you know, the barkeep just kind of nods his head and says, like, well, you're right. This is a good place to set up, but it's already been claimed. And he takes off his hat, and he's got a third eye. He's like, Venus claims it first.
Yeah.
Yep, that's the twist. The diner manager is Venusian.
Right.
Venusian.
You would think the twist would be the well-dressed man is a Martian, but the twist is actually the Venusian has been there as well.
Well, and the Venusian apparently destroyed the... crew that was coming to help out the well-dressed businessman.
Right.
That's
no one's coming.
Happen.
Yeah. Somehow he did that. Or his people did that. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, says the cook. This planet will be colonized, but by Venus. And if you're still alive, you will see. And he removes his hat to show a third eye. That is something.
The third eye was a piece of crap, but the three hands were pretty masterfully done.
I thought it was fine. You're fine. But yeah, no, it's good. And then we have the end narration. Incident on a small island, to be believed or disbelieved. However, if a sour-faced dandy named Ross or a big, good-natured counterman who handles the spatula as if he'd been born with it... And sorry, this is even dumber than that. If he'd been born with one in his mouth, if either of these two entities walk onto your premises, you'd better hold their hands, all three of them, or check the color of their eyes, all three of them. The gentleman in question might try to pull you into the Twilight Zone. This is something he does well, I think, which is that it's kind of the comedy. Like, it's a very silly episode. The fact that that this businessman who's just like got rump business is like the scout for an invading army, mm-hmm. and that Venus has beaten them to it is very silly. And that the businessman apparently is turning on and off the jukebox just to panic people.
It makes me wonder what the Venusian bartender was thinking when that was happening.
Well, because don't they have this line where it's like, I quite like this music. It's nothing we have on my planet. Nudge, nudge, nudge. And she's just like, we get it, dude. We get it, man.
It's a parlor trick.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
I like these corn dogs. It's not like nothing I have on my planet.
Oh, you don't have corn dogs on your planet. Are you really a planet?
That's exactly. Right.
Yeah.
You're right, though. Like, wet. What is this wet? And you're just like, Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's no water on Mars, is there?
I mean,
I
guess.
Yeah, there's water on Mars.
Well, yes, but I don't think they thought that. Well, maybe they didn't think
it was Venus. There's no water. But
well, yeah, because Venus has a
boiling.
Its average temperature is 700 degrees in the daytime.
Mars had canals and stuff. At least in the 60s, that's what they thought.
Okay.
But it's just everything about this episode where it's the dancer was I don't have ID. I sent it ahead with my luggage. You're like, well, that's possible, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. Everything is plausible. Every character before we get the twist is who's the alien? It could be the old guy who's just crazy with his eyes going in weird directions. It could be the bus driver. It could be any number of them. But mm-hmm. it could be, my thought was actually it was one of the police officers.
Yeah.
That would have made sense.
But it wasn't. But it could have been anybody. And that's where the paranoia comes in. And that's why I think this is just a fantastic episode.
The problem is you can't tamper with this episode because everything you add would make it somehow weirder. I always thought it would have been funny because I was thinking about this episode because I think it's great. Because there's that whole line with, I think it's Peter, the young guy. And he was and his wife suddenly didn't recognize the mole or thought he had a mole and didn't have a mole, whatever it was. If literally halfway through one of the characters changed, they changed actors. And then it just takes a second to acknowledge one of the people in the old couple suddenly changes. And there's just kind of because you really could do that.
Yeah.
And then there's suddenly and no one acknowledges it. But you as a viewer are wait. I swear that woman had
that would be fantastic. Can you imagine that? Like they just swap out the actors as the episode goes along, and
right?
you don't know, they don't acknowledge it?
Because the married couple has one scene, the old married couple has almost no lines. It's pretty much the dancer in the back, the businessman, and the crazy prospector up front. So if the people in the married couple kept changing, and maybe it's because essentially there's a sheriff and the deputy, and the sheriff does most of the talking, the deputy's just kind of folksy, he's done color commentary. If he kept looking at the couples and being like,
wasn't your mole on the other side? I have a mole.
I have a mole. Anyway, we should wrap this one up. Daniel, which one do you pick?
Oh, Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up by far. That's a much better example of what a classic Twilight Zone episode is. I mean, Long Distance Call was okay, but I think I would have enjoyed that more as just a random short story in a sci-fi book.
Isn't that what Twilight Zone is?
Yeah, but they adapted a ton from those, but at the end of the day, some worked, some didn't. And this is a case definitely where Martian, especially, just worked a lot more as a TV episode than a short story, whereas I think Long Distance Call would have worked better as a short story.
Yeah. John?
I agree. I loved the Martian one, again, like I said, because I loved the narrative setup of having everybody kind of stuck in one space, and you get the paranoia, you get the panic, you add in that tension, and utterly normal people suddenly start dissolving into, animals like we totally haven't seen during this pandemic.
They're right.
No, yeah, sure.
I thought it was fascinating, and the twist at the end was a bit hokey, but it is Twilight Zone, and it fit everything that we'd been led up to believe.
Sure.
The Long Distance Call was fine. It was more depressing than creepy, but it was good. So, yeah, I like the Martian one best.
I will also say something we didn't really touch on, but you really feel it when you compare these two episodes. Daniel mentioned that these were cheaper episodes. There were some cheaper episodes. Long Distance Call also doesn't look very good. It's not just that it's cheaper. It feels like a soap opera. It feels very flat. It doesn't look like, as opposed to With a Real Martian Stand-Up, which is filmed very dramatically, even though it's a comedy. And so, like, they do have sharp angles. Like, they do have, like, people in the distance and in the foreground and in the background. And it makes it feel like, as they pan around the room, like, it's adding tension to a comedy. Because, like, again, it is very comedic. But if the tension's not there, it's just a silly, stupid episode. It's not as intense as, say, Five Characters in Search of an Exit, which comes up soon. But it is, like, it is filmed more like a movie. Like, it's very dramatic. It's very cool.
It's where the director comes in to make what the writer came up with that much better.
And it's clearly filmed on better cameras and everything. Like, it's very dramatic.
Well, plus I can't imagine how old Kudat Bar would work on like a random page in a magazine, but I imagine it wouldn't be nearly as impactful.
Well, and that's why this works, right? Like, this one is fun. It's silly. It's and like I said, like at the end, the dialogue is almost stupid because it's like, again, it's Omen. It's Good Omen. It's like there's two warring factions trying to take over humanity. But you know, it works out. I think it's a very charming episode. So yeah, watch that one. And again, John, thanks for coming out. Listen to if join the Patreon because we're about to record an episode on Austin Powers, which will be our mission briefing. Which is the lowest level of Patreon. You get an extra episode once a month for Austin Powers.
At lowest, least. But not the worst.
No, that's right. The cheapest. And if you go to the next level, you also get an Alien movie. Though we're almost out of those, so we got to figure out what we're doing next. But with that in mind, of course, we will have at least Mission Briefing every month until No Time to Die comes out. And possibly after that. We've got to figure out what we're going to do with the show after that. But in the meantime, our weekly show on the Twilight Zone has reached its 8th episode. That means there's 5 left. So keep watching the skis, I guess. So, but stay tuned next week as we continue to follow the Twilight Zone. The Twilight Zone Zone is a production of Dude Letter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, paneled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is 6 Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Sterling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.